know that in a culture that does not protect the most dependent, the handicapped, the elderly, the unloved, or simply inconvenient, become increasingly vulnerable.
That was President Bush speaking via telephone, addressing yesterday's March for Life rally in Washington, D.C. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Welcome back for the second hour of the program. Here in this hour, Doug Johnson will be our guest in a few minutes. He's legislative director of National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C. We'll be talking about the prospects for pro-life legislation. Now, with a change of just a few seats in the Senate, Doug, in an official statement, is willing to say that he is guardedly optimistic about the chances for success in the Senate of a couple of bills. We'll find out what those are. Also, he'd like to clear up a few myths about Roe v. Wade here so near the 32nd anniversary of that landmark Supreme Court decision. And we'll also be talking about the future of the Supreme Court in general. Yesterday, we had a brief conversation on that, and it sounded as though, from Jeff Walz, what's most likely to happen is a wash. We'll get Chief Justice Rehnquist stepping down on account of his health. He'll be replaced within the court by someone like Antonin Scalia. And then Antonin Scalia, well, then there'll need to be a replacement there. And chances are, it'll be someone who will go relatively uncontested, be pro-life, but nothing's going to change as far as the makeup of the Supreme Court. By the way, one of those myths that Doug would like to clear up has to do with the makeup of the Supreme Court and the votes that are prevalent there. We'll be talking with him in just a minute. Now, later in this hour, Dr. David Scare will be our guest. We're going to continue an ongoing occasional series we're doing here in the month of January based on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. Dr. David Scare, of course, is the author of that book. He'll be with us in about 25 minutes. He's chairman of the Department of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. We're going to be discussing the parables in Matthew. And this comes as part of the third major block of conversation, discourse from our Lord in Matthew's gospel. These parables, these are familiar parables, the parable of the sower, the parable of the treasure hidden in the field, the parable of, what are the other ones? Oh, the parable of leaven. What do we make of all of these? Really, maybe we should back up and ask this question when we get Dr. Scare on the air, and that is, what in the world is a parable? There are some sayings of Jesus, especially in Matthew's gospel, that you might say are parabolic. They're metaphors. They're figures of speech. Does that make them parables? We'll get an answer to that question with Dr. David Scare. Then, in the third hour of Issues, Etc., we're going to be hearing some audio from the Life March, the pro-life march that was held in Washington, D.C., the March for Life. We heard the president there at the opening of this segment addressing that march via telephone. Now, we're going to hear varied views there in that third hour, and I think also from a Jewish rabbi who is pro-choice, if I am not mistaken, and we'll get your reaction to it as well. By the way, you can join us here in the second hour, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If you have a question or a comment on what lies ahead at the federal level, at the national level, for pro-life legislation. Doug Johnson is our guest. He's the legislative director for National Right to Life. He joins us from Washington, D.C. to give us a preview of what's coming up in the next 4 years or so. Well, at least the next Senate cycle on pro-life legislation. Doug, welcome back to Issues.
Good to be with you.
Doug, you put in a press release that National Right to Life is guardedly optimistic about the chances of certain issues in the Senate, given the change of a few seats there. First of all, how big of a change took place in November, and what are those issues that you're guardedly optimistic about?
Well, the change is depends on the exact issue that you're looking at, but it's on the order of three seats in the good direction. And there's 100 senators in the last Congress, the 2003-04 Congress. We had a Senate that was, the majority was definitely for Roe versus Wade and legal abortion. And we were still able to win on some things, but it was tough. Now we have a shift about three seats in the pro-life direction, so we still can by no means be complacent, and we're still going to lose on some important votes, particularly if we don't work real hard at the grassroots level. But we have a better chance now to get some more bills, pro-life bills, to President Bush, and are particularly excited about the prospects for a bill called the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act, and also another bill that would establish some protections for with respect to minor girls who cross state lines to get abortions and also protect the rights of their parents. So those are the two bills I would hope to see action on in the near future. And we still, as I say, are going to have tough fights on these, particularly in the Senate. But the House, we would expect to support them, and the President certainly supports them.
Doug Johnson, Legislative Director for National Right to Life, is our guest. They're based in Washington, D.C. We've got a kind of a iffy phone line with Doug. We're going to reconnect here for just a moment. Now, if you've got a question on these pieces of legislation, he mentioned two there. First of all, some legislation that would protect minor girls and the rights of their parents. This is pertinent to residents of Illinois. There is no parental consent law. There's no parental notification law in Illinois. Therefore, Illinois makes one of its major exports, abortion. There are minor girls who are carried across state lines, Missouri to Illinois, Kentucky to Illinois, Indiana to Illinois, Wisconsin to Illinois, Iowa to Illinois, in order to have abortions. So that's something that should be on the forefront of our minds here in this area. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The other one that he mentioned is the Unborn Pain Awareness Act. Now, this amounts to kind of para-abortion legislation because it doesn't strike at abortion itself, but it raises and sets into law, if possible, one of the principal foundation stones that in a case against abortion, and that is, does the fetus feel pain? And if the fetus does feel pain, now remember, this was a big issue, or I should say a non-issue, in the whole debate over partial birth abortion. You will remember that those who challenged the partial birth abortion ban found a judge who was willing to say, well, look, whether or not the fetus feels pain is irrelevant. We'll be talking more with Doug Johnson here about these two pieces of legislation. Doug, I want to talk about that Unborn Pain Awareness Act. What exactly does it stipulate?
Well, this is a continuation from the debate over partial birth abortion, where one of the things that Congress found out in hearings was that this process of partial birth abortion would be excruciatingly painful for the unborn child. This process of being mostly delivered alive and then having a sharp scissors thrust through the base of the skull and so forth. And Congress ultimately included that finding in the bill, which is now the law, and it's been further explored in federal court trials and challenges to the bill. Now, this new bill, the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act, would apply to all methods of abortion, and it would that's to say, if a woman approaches an abortionist anywhere in the United States seeking an abortion after 20 weeks, which is roughly 4.5 months, he would be required to provide her with information specified in the law about the overwhelming scientific evidence that her baby will experience great pain, has the capacity to experience great pain during the abortion. And she would also have to sign a form that would either accept or reject the administration of pain-reducing drug for the baby. Now, this would apply again to any method of abortion past that stage of development. And we think that there is a wealth of information that this is so, but it is not information to which the average person has had any exposure. And it certainly is something that might cause some people in that situation to stop and think about the decision in a new light.
The other piece of legislation that you said has a better prospect now after the November elections in the Senate is has to do with the transportation of minor girls and their parents' rights to know or be informed or give consent when they travel across state lines for abortion. How common is this?
Well, it appears to be very common. It's particularly common where you have a state like Missouri or many others. About half the states have laws in effect that require that an abortionist notify a parent before performing an abortion on a minor girl, or at least that there be a judge, a state court, that authorizes that notification to be waived. But those laws are often evaded by people taking these minor girls across state lines to neighboring states where they have no such requirement. For example, it's often the case that minor girls in Missouri are taken to Illinois, which has no notification requirement. And that's intrastate activity, that crossing state lines, which the individual state really can't deal with effectively. And that's why Congress has to get involved. And Congress, we think appropriately, should curb that type of activity and protect the, certainly to protect the welfare of these minor girls, but also the rights of their parents.
On the front of the U.S. Supreme Court, you say that the defeat of Democratic leader Tom Daschle in South Dakota as Senate Minority Leader was significant and may mean something for future appointments to the Supreme Court. How so?
Well, it certainly bears on the whole question of the confirmation of nominees to the federal courts, because we saw something over the past 2 years that was quite appalling, where the Senate Democrats, almost as a block, with just a couple of exceptions, obstructed numerous appointments to the federal courts, particularly to the very important courts of appeals. And they did this by refusing to allow up and down votes on these nominees. Now, any one of these well-qualified nominees would have been confirmed by a majority of the elected senators if they'd been permitted to vote. But in a way that had never been done before, the Senate Democrats, again with just a couple of exceptions, prevented those votes from happening. And that became a major issue in the Senator Daschle's re-election campaign, that his leadership and that obstructionism came back to bite him big time, and that was one of the reasons he lost his seat. It's also been an important issue in a number of other U.S. Senate races in 2004 and also in 2002. So I think that some of the Senate Democrats are starting to get pretty nervous about this, and they ought to, because what they've been doing is simply blocking well-qualified nominees at the dictate of certain pressure groups. There's a coalition of liberal pressure groups in which the pro-abortion advocacy groups are major players, and they have basically been sending marching orders to the U.S. Senate Democrats saying, we don't like this nominee or that one or that one. It doesn't matter all of their accomplishments. It doesn't matter that they've got the highest rating from the American Bar Association. We demand that you block them, and they've been doing it. They've been jumping every time. So we'll see if that keeps happening. But you can bet that when there is a vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court, that this entire coalition of well-funded pro-abortion liberal interest groups is going to demand that that nominee be obstructed. And that's when we're going to really see the fur fly.
Has the president weighed in on either the Unborn Pain Child Awareness Act or the act that would protect the rights of children and parents across state lines for abortions, or, for that matter, either implicitly or explicitly, on who he might like to see as a nominee in this next term for the Supreme Court?
Well, to take the last question first, the president, to my knowledge, has not given any indication of who he would pick for a vacancy that hasn't occurred yet. I'm sure that would be a decision they'd look at very carefully when the time comes. But he has certainly described his criteria for judicial appointments, including Supreme Court appointments, and he did that when he sought the presidency for the first time. He's reiterated it even in recent interviews, and essentially it's he wants judges who will confine themselves to being judges, which is an important job, but who do not regard themselves as having any right to be super legislators. He wants jurists who will not impose their policy preferences from the bench in the guise of constitutional law. This is corrosive to democracy, and of course it's the way we got legal abortion on demand. It was a decision by a number of Supreme Court justices that they thought as a policy matter abortion ought to be legal, and so they decided to make it so and to call it constitutional law, which it wasn't. It was an abuse of power, and the president wants judges who won't do that. Of course, we think those are the kind of judges who, when the time comes to revisit Roe versus Wade, are going to say, hey, there's nothing in the Constitution to base this on. We're going to overturn this decision, and we're going to let elected lawmakers decide what the policy ought to be with respect to unborn children or abortion.
The name Tim Romer, I believe it is, has come up as a possible, at least he seems willing to serve as a possible head for the Democratic National Committee. Now, first of all, how likely do you think that is, that he would be chosen? He is, in fact, a pro-life Democrat. And if it were to happen, what would it mean?
Well, we haven't taken any position on who should be the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. I can affirm that when he was a member of the House of Representatives for about 10 years that Congressman Romer did vote pro-life. There was a poll done by some organ of the media of the actual voting members of the Democratic National Committee and just a few days ago, and Romer did very poorly. The pro-abortion activists regrettably still have a locked grip on a lot of the levers of power in the Democratic Party, even though that has cost them so dearly in elections. So I don't know who's going to win that contest, but just based on that poll, it doesn't look too encouraging for Mr. Romer. You asked me a minute ago about the president's position on the two bills that I've been talking about, and President Bush does support both of those bills, and that support was reiterated at the White House just yesterday. And, of course, that's been the pattern on all of the pro-life bills that have been under active consideration. The president and his appointees have weighed in the congressional fights. They've helped to defeat the crippling amendments. And, of course, he has signed these bills just as fast as he could, and they've been defending the bill, the partial birth law, very ably in the federal court. So he's done everything he can, but we have to do our part, and we have our work cut out for us, particularly in the U.S. Senate, to get the votes to get these bills to the president.
Several weeks ago, I got an email from a listener who had been doing some research, not so much into what the bills that the president had signed or promised to sign, but in the bills that the president had not vetoed. And they had assembled a list about a page long of various bills that furthered, I think they put it in terms of public funding for abortion in various ways, that the president allowed to go with his signature.
Yeah, I think I've seen that document going around, that email, and that's totally bogus. There may be some other issues discussed in it that I don't have knowledge of, but with respect to the abortion policy issues, it's totally bogus. President Bush has done everything within the reach of his power to curb any kind of federal subsidies for abortion, and I'll give you a couple examples. By executive order, his very first executive order, his first working day in office in 2001, was to cut off funds for overseas groups that promote abortion, even with their own money. He said, none of our tax dollars, foreign aid dollars, should go to overseas groups like Planned Parenthood that think they have a mission to promote abortion. And, of course, that's been challenged in court, and it's been attacked in the Congress, particularly in the Senate, but that's still the policy today, and that's a policy that he was able to do strictly on his own authority, and it has stuck. Now, there's some other things that he doesn't have authority to do, but he has done everything that's within his power. And another example is that the administration has enforced the law against funding agencies that support programs of coercion in foreign countries, and they have cut off the UN Population Fund, which is an agency that was fully funded, notwithstanding the law, during the Clinton administration, but it's been cut off because of their support for China's population control program. So I could go through a long list, but there is no validity to any claim that this administration has supported any type of abortion activities that they had the power to prevent.
You often feel the need to clear up myths about Roe v. Wade in particular. I want to deal with two in the time that's left to us here, Doug. First of all, it is often reported that the Supreme Court is divided 5-4 on Roe v. Wade. If we could just get that one more vote, we'd have it overturned. Is that true?
Regrettably, that is not true. As the current Supreme Court, there are 6 justices who support Roe, and there are 3 who have argued for the overturning of Roe. So that's something of a myth. Now, it is true that on the issue of partial birth abortion, the current Supreme Court is divided 5-4 in favor of partial birth abortion. And that's the case, that's the issue that's most likely to come before the court next. Now, the difference is that one justice, Anthony Kennedy, regrettably, he's for Roe versus Wade. He voted to reaffirm Roe versus Wade. Regrettably, he has not changed his mind on that. He thinks abortion should be legal for any reason up until the point that the child can survive independently of the mother. And even after that, if there's so-called health justifications, that's what he thinks. But he also thought it should be permitted for the states to ban the partial birth abortion method, that particular method. So he voted to uphold the Nebraska law on partial birth abortions 4 years ago. So on that issue of partial birth abortion, we just need a change of one vote to uphold the national ban that President Bush signed. And that's the case that's already on its way up to the Supreme Court. But on Roe versus Wade itself, the question of whether legal abortion on demand is going to remain legal, then we need two more. We need a switch of two. And if that were to occur, then the matter of protecting the unborn would really be back in the hands of elected lawmakers again, which is where it was before there was a Roe versus Wade.
And in that connection, there are many who believe that overturning Roe v. Wade, if those two votes in this court were to be had, would automatically ban all abortions. Sounds like from what you just said, that's not true.
No, because we live in a democracy in which you actually have to pass laws through these legislative bodies. And we find encouragement in the polls, which show that when you ask people where they think the lines should be drawn, what protections there should be for unborn children, when abortion should be permitted, if it should ever be permitted, we find substantial majorities for pro-life policies, for policies that would eliminate most abortions, or another way to say it, for protections for the unborn child that are far, far more extensive than anything permitted under Roe versus Wade. So, you know, of course, there has to be effective political action. There has to be awareness on the part of citizens as to what the legislatures are doing. But if the public opinion expressed in these polls could be translated into actual laws, we would be infinitely better off than we are now under the Supreme Court's decree. And that's why we're working for that day.
And why, with only a minute here, Doug, is that public support you listed in your press release for these various laws and bills, why is it not translated into legislative support?
Well, it often is, but then the courts knock it down. As on partial birth abortion, more than half the states passed bans on partial birth abortion. But five lawyers on the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated all of those laws 4 years ago in one fell swoop. That's why we need reform at the Supreme Court, because otherwise you could pass a lot of things, but ultimately you have these judges who think they should be able to decide everything important and be super legislators. They're the ones who have the final word. We need judges who will confine themselves to judging and let the elected lawmakers make the laws.
NRLC.org is the website address for National Right to Life. NRLC.org. Doug Johnson, Legislative Director for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C., has been our guest. Doug, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks so much.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be spending some time talking with Dr. David Scare about the parables in the Gospel of Matthew. Of course, Matthew is littered with parables, but there is a section that is almost entirely parables, and as Dr. Scare will argue on the far side of the break, it is unique among the discourses in Matthew in that, well, when the other discourses end, when you come to, say, the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew usually signals it by saying something like, when Jesus had finished speaking all these words, etc., etc. Well, this discourse, the third, the one that deals mostly with Matthew's parables from the mouth of Jesus, it ends with when Jesus had finished all these parables. Well, what is a parable? You could say it's an extended metaphor. Well, what does that mean? I remember learning, and maybe you did too, an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Does that cover what a parable is? And what are the parables? Why are they so perplexing in Matthew's gospel? We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Today, everyone hails Jesus as a great teacher. But what did Jesus really teach? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for January is Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church, by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. David Scare. Discourses in Matthew is $29.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or go online to our website, issuesetc.org, and look under the What's New section for more information and a way to order the Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church, by Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. David Scare.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Detmer. An organization seeking to change young students' attitudes about homosexuality has found a willing accomplice in the media to belittle Dr. James Dobson. The controversy began after Dobson spoke out against the group's agenda. Stuart Shepard reports.
It started with the New York Times article that distorted comments made by Dobson. Then the Today Show and other outlets picked it up.
Now some other conservative Christians are putting the squeeze on SpongeBob.
It all traces back to the We Are Family Foundation that will be sending 61,000 copies of this video to elementary schools in March. It features numerous cartoon characters. Nile Rodgers, the man behind the song and the video, told the Today Show,
"Not only is it not pro-homosexual, but it has nothing to do with sexuality."
True, the video itself does not, but it's designed to compel kids to take a tolerance pledge that puts sexual identity on par with race, religion, and gender. And Rodgers' website featured numerous teacher resources written from a pro-homosexual point of view, or at least it did. They vanished over the weekend.
As we continue on Hannity and Combs, I'm Sean Hannity.
On Fox News, Dobson said the mainstream media is distorting his statements, focusing on SpongeBob while ignoring Rogers' agenda.
If there's going to be a campaign like this to change the attitudes of kids and get them to pledge something, the parents ought to know about it.
Meantime, the We Are Family Foundation has threatened to sue the American Family Association over the same controversy. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
The We Are Family Foundation website contains links to five of the largest gay organizations in the country, including groups that make a point of using the cloak of tolerance to push its agenda in schools. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Detmer.
Alcoholism at home or in the parish. Respectful intervention in conflict resolution. The presence of technology and how to control what seems to overwhelm our families. You can get good information and advice about these important subjects at the Family Shield Communication Seminar on Wednesday, February 2nd on Concordia Seminary's campus. It's hope for families just like yours. Registration begins at 8:45 a.m. The cost is $10. Visit FamilyShieldMinistries.com for more information.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January will help you better understand Jesus' parables. It's titled Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. The number at Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours is 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. Discourses in Matthew by Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. David Scare.
Welcome back. Halfway through Issues Etc. today, Dr. David Scare joins us for about 25 minutes. We're going to be talking with him about the third discourse in Matthew's Gospel, his book, Our Issues Etc., Book of the Month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church, walks through the five discourses in Matthew. I'll tell you a little bit more about the book a little later in our conversation. This third one is unique because it deals with the parables. Now, there are parables in other parts of Matthew's Gospel, but this one is almost entirely parables. It begins and it ends in a peculiar way. But first, we've got to clear up this whole question of what a parable is in the first place. Dr. David Scare is our guest, chairman of the Department of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. Dr. Scare, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be here, Todd.
We're going to be talking a lot about the parables in Matthew here, beginning in chapter 12, near the end there, 12 verse 46, through the end of chapter 13 in Matthew. What is a parable?
A parable is a story which intends to involve the reader in such a way that he does not realize that he may be the subject, or at least included in the parable, and he does not know the conclusion. Scholars have tried to formulate one definition for a parable, but really no one definition fits. It's really a story that makes a comparison with in terms other than in theological terms.
So we all learned, or most of us might have learned, this little phrase, earthly story, heavenly meaning, does that even touch upon what a parable? That seems awfully general.
Well, yeah, I would have a little difficulty with an earthly story with a heavenly meaning, simply because in the parable comes closest to how Jesus taught. A parable was the ordinary way in which Jesus taught. It was a common way of speaking. The significance of the parable is that the punchline is not known until one comes to the conclusion. So one doesn't know whether he's going to be caught or not. The classical parable is from the Old Testament, in which after David has committed adultery with Uriah's wife, Nathan comes to him and tells him the story of a wealthy man who takes the lamb of a poor person and takes it for himself. And David gets irate, and he says, that man has to be killed for doing such an awful thing. And then the parable concludes when Nathan says to David that he is the man who took another man's possession for his own pleasure. And I suppose all preaching should be parabolic, in the sense that the person who is listening to it has his mind on another subject, and at the conclusion he finds out what the answer is. It's very much like a good story or a good joke. What makes good humor is that we do not realize that we are hearing humor until the conclusion.
You mentioned that parable that the prophet Nathan tells David. Now, it operates on a second level in that story, because the reader of the story knows full well what the parable is about. It's only David who's in the dark until the end. But the parables of Jesus, especially in Matthew's gospel, we don't often know. Even the reader doesn't have any special knowledge as to what the parable is about, while the disciples and others may be in the dark. The reader is kind of in the same position as the disciples.
That's absolutely true. There is a certain rhyme and reason to the parables. And that is, in regard to the parables of Matthew, there is a rhyme and a reason to it. They're very well organized. The parables in Matthew serve this particular purpose: they are the parables which are less about Jesus and more about the reader. Now, the subject in each one of the parables is Jesus, but in hearing the parables in the last chapter. Matthew chapter 13, the person who is listening to these parables is hearing something about himself. Now, when he detects this, that would be difficult to say. However, in the parable of the sower, the attention is on the seed. It was common to think of the Word of God as the seed. And so the points of the parable are already known by the listener. Now, as you mentioned, in the case of David hearing that parable, he does not really know that he is the subject of the parable until the conclusion. But there are certain indications in the Gospel of Matthew that the hearer of the parable is well acquainted with the terminology.
I have also heard it said that Jesus used parables in order to impart knowledge, in this case about the kingdom of heaven, that phrase that is so near and dear in Matthew's gospel, to his initiates, to his disciples, while at the same time to hide the same truths from people who may be hearing it, for whom he does not want to reveal these things.
Well, you bring up a controversial issue. And that there are two opinions about the parables. The one you just mentioned, that the parable is spoken in mysterious language so that outsiders can't understand it. The other interpretation is that the mysteries are the doctrines which are contained in the parables rather than the language itself. I think the parables were immediately understood by both the believers, the followers of Jesus, the disciples, and also the enemies of Jesus, because they understand that they were being talked about. that frequently, I think every preacher has had this experience, that after he has preached the sermon, someone may come up to him and say, "Were you preaching about me?" even though there was no explicit reference. I don't believe that the parabolic language is that mysterious. Amazingly, the parables of Jesus, even though they are first century, they come from the first century and reflect the time of Palestine in the first few years of the first century, deal with universal themes. So they are a man going out to sow seed. The most common occupation in the world is farming and planting. And so even a person in an urban setting would not find this to be beyond his comprehension.
As we said before, each of the parables here in this discourse that we're talking about begins with the phrase, "The kingdom of heaven is like," or "it can be compared to." You mentioned that these are very carefully put together.
Yes.
By Matthew. Can you discern for us and explain to us kind of the structure of these parables in this discourse in Matthew?
Yes, and that is, the last two times we got together, we discussed the first discourse, the Sermon on the Mount, which are the rules of the community. Any society, I always like to use the example of the military, you learn how do you relate to people. You have orientation week at college. The second week explains who's in charge of the community, and the answer is the apostles. In the third discourse, which are the parables, which are chiefly covered in Matthew chapter 13, I don't want to use the word self-centered, but they're Christian-centered. The person begins to look upon himself of how he got in that situation. And the first parable has to do with belief and unbelief. The person who is hearing the parable is a believer. And he hears the story of the parable of the sower. And it has to do with the preaching of Jesus, the word of God. I think we just better say the preaching of Jesus. And the question is, and this is a question that many Christians have, especially when they're members in their family who are not Christians or don't go to church. The question is this: how is it that I am a Christian and my husband, my wife, my children, my brother and sister, my mother and father are not? And the answers are given by Jesus by the various reactions to what happens to the seed. Within some seed falls upon the hard ground and simply is taken away. It would be like planting something on a concrete street. It's just, the chances of it growing are very slim. In other case, the soil is not deep enough. And I believe in the third case, it has to do with it's choked out by weeds. And what are the things that destroy the plant? It's really the last one, which is the most significant. They are choked. They do not believe. The plant doesn't grow. They do not believe because they are choked by the pleasures and the pursuits of this world, which is a commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, the first discourse. You cannot serve God and mammon. And I don't know if you want me to go on at this time, but the second discourse builds on that one. In the second discourse, the good seeds are growing, and the enemy, who is Satan, comes in and plants weeds so that you have both growing side by side. And so there is a magnificent progression, a literary progression, from one parable to another. The seed that is productive and survives in the first parable becomes the major subject of the second parable. It's growing, it's perfect, it's very nice, and then there is intrusion into the field with the planting of the weeds.
So in a way, the first and second parable here in this discourse in Matthew build upon one another. I want to come back to that parable of the sower, though, lest the hearer at Jesus' time misunderstand, or the hearer at our time misunderstand. It has often been preached, that parable of the sower, kind of as the, well, okay, what kind of soil are you going to be, putting the onus for the fruitfulness, the seed taking root entirely upon the Christian, leaving out any notion that this is, in fact, the word itself that produces faith and the fruits of faith.
Well, the parable should be taken not as an explanation of why some people don't believe. It should be taken as a description of what happens to other people, why they don't believe. And I think it's of all the parables, this is kind of crucial, because pastors are faced with this particular problem of why some people, their friends and family, don't believe. They hear the same word, and it doesn't answer the question of why one soil is the way it is. The soil can't change itself. It should really be called the parables of the soil, because it is a description of humankind. The soils in no way carry imperative or command of what an individual should be. The soil does not determine its own character. By looking at Matthew 13, the parables, we get the ordinary way in which Jesus preached. And we have to shy away from the idea that this is a mysterious language. We are given explanations for two of the parables, the first two, the sower and the seed and the soils, and the other, the weeds. We are not given explanations for the other parables. However, the evangelist, St. Matthew, expects that having been given instruction about two of the parables, that the reader will know how to figure out the rest of the parables. It's very much like a person who works on General Motors cars, and he has an opportunity to work on Ford cars or cars or any other kind of other vehicle. There are certain things in the other cars which are different, but he knows the general principle. And the parables, I'm always amazed at them, because it really begins with a person coming to faith. And it ends up with parables on the atonement and the final judgment. So it takes the believer through his entire life, and, of course, after death, and how he will appear before God.
Dr. David Scare is our guest. We're talking about parables in the Gospel of Matthew, discussing the third discourse based upon his book, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Scare is chairman of the Department of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. The next parable that comes up is the parable of the mustard seed. Now, you said that these build upon one another. Why this one here?
Well, in this, going back to the first parable, it's the reason that some people do not believe is because of persecution. If they believe, they'll give up the pleasantries of life. So in the first parable, you have wheat seeds. In the second parable, the wheat seeds are growing, and you have weeds. The third parable builds upon the wheat, upon the seed, rather. Instead of being a wheat seed or a weed seed, weed and wheat are very close together, you have a mustard seed. And so you're dealing now with one seed and not many seeds, and there's no evil involved. Now, this is also an amazing parable. It's called the smallest seed, and yet it produces a pretty big bush in which the birds of the air can come in and find refuge. Now, all of a sudden, you start off in the first parable of, hey, I'm a Christian, I'm a believer in Christ, but somebody else isn't. Boy, how did that happen? The second one has to do with, I'm a believer, but the guy sitting next to me, I have good evidence he's not a believer. And the point of that parable is, it's not for you to decide, it's not for you to pass judgment on other people. God will pass judgment. You could very well be right that the person next to you is an unbeliever, is a hypocrite, is covering up. But that's not for you to decide. You have to have both. The third parable, the one of the mustard seed, and also the mustard seed, is that a small thing accomplishes great things. What we have in the parable of the mustard seed and the mustard tree is a picture of the church. This huge assembly of people who all believe the same things. A little seed accomplishes great things, which now leads in to the next parable of the leaven, or the yeast. I want to be very careful with yeast. I'm not much of a baker. I'm no baker at all. But I understand some horrendous things have happened because people have mismeasured yeast. And they've had all kinds of explosions. And the connection there is the small mustard seed, that parable, is followed by the leaven or the yeast. St. Paul speaks a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. Now, what's amazing about that parable is that yeast, frequently in the Jewish mind, is not a proper, can refer to evil. But here it refers to the great things that God's word can be done. And I think that's I think anybody who has been involved with the church, in many go back to the first parable. The first parable of the sower who sows the seed, and some never believe, some believe for a little while, some believe almost to the final end and then move away. That's the hard knocks of life. This is the frustration that we have to experience. I think any kind of mission program or evangelism program that sets out to convert a specific number of people to Christianity and to Christ, I think it's well-intentioned, but it overlooks the fact that it's God who's going to decide what's going to happen. And that is complete desperation. In a sense, there's a kind of a desperation in the first parable. Only a little seed comes to its conclusion. Well, in the parable of the mustard seed and the parable of the yeast in the dough, it's entirely different. Here we thought we were losing. Here we thought nobody would believe our message, and there we are faced with the church as an eternal reality spanning time and spanning place. And these parables have to do with the victory of the church.
Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Before we go to the phone call here, Dr. Scare, would you be willing to stay with us for just a few minutes on the other side of this break?
Sure.
All definitely. Right. Let's go to the phones and talk with Ed, who calls from Kirkwood, and we'll have time for an answer here before this break. Ed, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, thank you. Dr. Scare, if you have someone who believes in double predestination and uses the parable of the sower, what's the best way to refute that?
Good question. Now, for our listeners' sake, double predestination generally is the idea that God has predestined both the elect and the unelect, that he's predestined some to eternal salvation and some to eternal condemnation, but that every man in God's eternal foreknowledge and predestination is assigned one of those two places. It's an unscriptural doctrine. But how do you deal with someone who argues for it on the basis of the parable of the sower?
I'll go back to what I did before. The parable is descriptive of the condition. It does not explain why the conditions of the soil. It teaches the universality or the effectiveness of the word. In all cases, the seed has the power within itself to generate. Now, in regard to double predestination, the word does not have the power to regenerate. Does not have the power to regenerate regardless of what kind of soil it falls upon. The attention in the parable is on the seed itself, which is the gospel. I hate the word of God is a good phrase, but it really is the preaching of salvation by Jesus about himself. And the problem of unbelief is one that Matthew has to face. he has to face in regard to the Jews. You know, John says it very clearly. He came to his own, and his own received him not. In Matthew, it's not as explicit, but it's there just as much, that the people who should believe don't believe. And the parable should really be taken as a form of encouragement rather than a predetermination. Encouragement in the sense that God is the one who is going to determine what's going to happen. And we should not take upon ourselves any kind of guilt because certain things did not come to pass.
And to put a finer point on it, as our time runs down, Dr. Scare, you said before that in the parable of the sower, if we read what it actually says, the word has the power to regenerate regardless of what soil it falls upon. That is never in question, but the doctrine of predestination would deny. It would talk about an ineffective word or a gospel that does not call because the person who receives it is not elect in the first place.
Well, yes, the attention is on the word rather than, I mean, so far as the efficacy is concerned.
So, in a nutshell, can the parable of the sower be used to legitimize the teaching of double predestination?
Well, whoever believes in double predestination is going to find as many possible passages to prove it. So we cannot stop them from doing that, but it certainly does not.
We're talking with Dr. David Scare. The parables in the Gospel of Matthew are the subject of our discussion. He's going to stay with us for a few minutes. On the other side of the break, he's chairman of the Department of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January, titled Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. Now, if you have a question or a comment on these parables, call during this break, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Scare will be with us for a few minutes. Then we're going to be hearing some audio from the March for Life in Washington, D.C. that took place yesterday. We heard a little bit before in a previous conversation. The president phoned in his comments to that March for Life. He addressed the people assembled there in Washington, D.C. We'll hear from some others when we conclude our conversation with Dr. David Scare. Those call-in numbers, if you have a question or a comment on these parables in Matthew, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, so far, we've dealt with these parables, and Dr. Scare has shown us how they build upon one another here in this third discourse in Matthew. When we come back, two more parables, and what has always sounded to me and seemed to me one of the most enigmatic sayings of our Savior. Well, the parables are the parable of the treasure in the field and the parable of the good and the bad fish, sometimes called the parable of the dragnet. Are they just reiterations of previous parables? There do seem to be some parallels there. But what do we make of this ending of this discourse where Jesus talks about a scribe who goes in and from the old and the new takes out things of use? I don't know what it means. We'll find out when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.